Yeah, so we're ready to start? Is it
Yeah, I think so. I just want to let people know in case you're interested in, if you didn't start at the beginning and you want to continue with Discovering Buddhism, this is the last class in this cycle, but we're going to be starting the next cycle in January, and the first class will be either the 4th or the 11th. So I have to haven't confirmed with the teacher of that class yet. So it'll go up on the calendar pretty soon. But just to let you know, and I want to congratulate everybody for helping us finish out a cycle of Discovering Buddhism. And because of COVID, we're not having a party. But congratulations to everybody, including our wonderful teachers, for completing a whole other cycle of DB. Don, I leave it to you now.
Okay. Let's see, who's here? We have 10 sentient beings at least. How are you? I can't see all of them, Donna. How do I get everybody?
Look in your upper right corner of your screen, and there's like a little tiny grid there. And if you put your cursor on it, it'll say gallery view. And if you click on that, then you can see everybody's face.
Does it say thumbnail?
No, it should say gallery view. Oh, the thumbnail is a way of seeing everybody, but you should be able to.
I don't see anything in my. Oh, wait a minute. Speaker.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I don't see. I see a few people, and I see pictures. That's funny. Okay, hi. So welcome to the last night. And unfortunately, or actually fortunately for you, Venerable George, gave an excellent discussion of Tantra and gave you some things to think about. You know, Tantra is kind of the... It is the hardest thing to teach in Discovering Buddhism to make it relevant to people because it's so out there. We just don't have any, we have no concept. Honestly, I don't. I mean, when I first got introduced to Buddhism and Tantra, I went, wow, what is that? That is so different from the, from the, basically the lower scope teachings or the, causal teachings. These are the resultant teachings or tantric teachings. But anyway, I'm not going to be negative about this. We're going to be positive and try to come up with something, plant some seeds of virtue. I just read a note just before I came online. It was another center teacher, and he was talking about how he just felt like Tantra was so disconnected from everything else that was being taught and at the center, and just how it's so hard to teach. He didn't feel qualified to teach. All those things I can relate to. But Lama Zopa Rinpoche's response was, well, talk about it. Do the best you can. I mean, and he did talk a little bit about Highest Yoga Tantra, which I don't really feel like talking about, because I think that's not helpful, frankly. I'm most interested in giving people some information or experiences that might be, that I perceive to be helpful. And I've taught this class probably 10 times, and I'm the only one at the center that's ever taught it, which means I'm going straight to the Vajra Hells when this is over. And I'm ready. I know it's going to be hot down there, but whatever. But I have had some experience of Tantra, and the experience I had actually was with let's put it this way. It could have been a 3-month, but I squeezed it into a 2.5-month retreat in Vajrasattva in Sri Lanka back in the 80s, Lama Zopa Rinpoche said, I went to Lama Yeshe and I said, I really feel like I need to purify. And so the teaching, the class that everybody, well, the practice that most of the students back in the 80s did was Vajrasattva, 100,000 mantra, Vajrasattva mantras. And so I went to Lama Yeshe. I said, I really need to purify. I know I need to. And he said, go ask Lama Zopa where to go. At this time, we were in Dharamsala, India, up in where the Dalai Lama lives. And yeah, that's right. We were in Dharamsala. So I went to see Lama Zopa. Lama Zopa does his divination. And he says, oh, yeah, Sri Lanka, Kandy. Like, this is a Theravada country, you know? It's a beautiful, beautiful country. It's a little island south of India. So I found my way to Sri Lanka and I went to Kandy, which is a beautiful hill station, beautiful community, and I found a tea plantation that had a meditation retreat center on the tea plantation. It was a Vipassana, but that's okay. And they had a little hut, maybe about a quarter of a mile from, maybe less, but it seemed like that long, from the meditation center. And that's where I ended up parking myself for the next 2.5 months. And so I did have that experience for 2.5 months, every day. I'm going to say 8 to 10 hours a day, really trying my best to practice Vajrasattva, do the Vajrasattva practice. And I'll be honest with you, the only thing that pulled me through was Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa. Honest to God, their blessings, every time I thought of them and their wishes for me to be happy, and at least that was my perception, and I do believe it's true. It really kept me alive during that 2.5 months by myself, where I met every demon I had ever created in my life came to visit me on that retreat, and I got to see it for what it was, and I tried to remember, you know, one of the things you try to practice is to see your mind, your guru's mind, and the daddy's mind is inseparably one. Okay? So emptiness is a big part of that. So not being caught by all of this stuff that keeps, and Vajrasattva is like a roto-rooter for pulling up basically things, negativities, even things that we may not even be aware of from past lives can come up in the middle of it in the form of physical pain or just mental chaos. And the whole thing is, the Vajrasattva is a highest yoga tantric practice, at least the version I did. And it was the most wonderful thing I have ever done in my life. And it permanently connected me to Buddha Dharma. And I didn't come out of that enlightened. I came out of that practice seeing how unenlightened I was. No, it was in a good way. It was a beautiful practice because I realized that I had no control over my mind. Like, what is going to come up next? I had no control. When you're sitting in retreat and you're focusing on the deity, and you're trying to see yourself and the guru's mind, and your mind is inseparably one, and you focus on the deity, you realize, and then stuff just keeps coming up, and you have no idea. I mean, it could be 45 minutes of bliss beyond anything, physical and mental bliss beyond anything imagine, that I've ever imagined. Or it could be an hour of hell like the hell realms. There was no way to predict how any one session was going to go. It was what it was. And so tantric practice is a little bit that way. People say it's dangerous, and I think it can be dangerous, particularly if you think you can do it on your own without a strong connection to a teacher. I think that is the key to success. Actually, in Dharma practice, if you want to know the truth, otherwise it becomes just another really nice philosophy. There are a lot of good philosophies out there. People write books every day about how to be happy, how to do this. You know, there's a lot of new age stuff out there, a lot of sort of old age stuff there. There are a lot of ways in the world to find a peace of mind and happiness. But the thing that makes Buddha Dharma real for me, and I'm speaking from my own experience, are the living examples of the teachings. And for me, it was Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa and His Holiness the Dalai Lama. And I spent most of my time around Lama Zopa, a lot of time around Lama Yeshe, and a fair amount of time around Dalai Lama. And I got to see these exemplars of the practice of Tantra, which is their main practice. And they're extraordinary human beings. So, you know, my greatest hope for teaching this class is to plant some seeds that may, don't even think about this life. You know, it could be this life, but maybe not. But at some point in the future, that number one, you meet a qualified guru or teacher that you connect with in your heart of hearts. Because otherwise, as Venerable George said in his teachings, the Dharma becomes like eating saltines, kind of dry. Doesn't have any moisture to it. Doesn't have any heart to it. Having a living example, like these three teachers that I have connected with, is like a crucial thing. And you can have can read the books and you can feel good about it. And that's all good and well. But the real power of Buddha Dharma only comes alive through a connection with a qualified teacher. And for many of us, you might say, well, the Dalai Lama's my guru because you never met him. I was fortunate enough to have met him many times, but you never met him. So, but you could still see him as your guru, as somebody that you have faith in, and you can feel a heart connection to him, because he really is the real deal. He's the real deal. He walks the talk, just like Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa did. So I just want to start out with that little bit, and then we're going to do a meditation in just a second. But I wanted to say, go back and repeat some of the things I said in the first class. We talked a little bit about, how was your day today? Yeah? How was your day today? Anybody give me a thumbs up, thumbs down, neutral? What do you say? I say a couple of thumbs up, one thumb down, neutral. Yeah, Don, I didn't see which way you're, okay, good, thank you. So, you know, and maybe during the day sometimes it was thumbs up, sometimes it was thumbs down, but sometimes it was neutral, right? I mean, it was like whatever it was. But what do we want tomorrow to be like? We want up or down? Up. And the day after tomorrow, up. And the day after that, and the day after that, up. And after that, up. And after that, up. And after that, up. And even when we're dying, we want it to be what? Up. We want to die with a happy mind, right? Okay? So if you had a good day or a bad day, why? Ask that question in first class. Anybody want to speak up? Because this is a no-brainer here. If you've made it this far in discovering Buddhism, this ought to be a no-brainer. Why was it a good day or a bad day?
I think it's just because of the thoughts that we paid attention to.
Which is another way of saying what?
I don't know. Like where we put our attention and focused on what positive thoughts or negative thoughts. I'm not sure.
It's our mind.
Yeah.
It's our mind. Our mind determines our attitude, our perception, as you say. Our mind is the cause of happiness. Whether we got a good day or a bad day is totally dependent upon the mind, isn't it? You know, like, you know, I said this, I've been to Disney World. I've been to the Magic Kingdom. And it was like hell because my kids were acting up like you wouldn't believe. And I should have been happy, but I wasn't. Should have been, but I wasn't. And I was there when I have been happy. So again, the mind. So if the mind is the chief determinant of our, whether we have this kind of day or this kind of day or this kind of day, is it, and we all want this kind of day, it's worth putting the effort into training the mind, right? Into making some conscientious effort to develop and train our mind in a positive way. So, again, in Buddhism, that's, you know, we have a beautiful, it's kind of amazingly laid out in the three principles of the path. Sometimes we talk about that. Sometimes we talk about we talk about sutra and tantra. We talk about the causal vehicle and the resultant vehicle. We talk about the three higher trainings, ethics, concentration, and wisdom. We talk about the six perfections, you know, which are, anybody know what the six perfections are? I'm trying to remember them now real quick while I'm going. But anyway, you remember what they are?
Generosity.
It's important. I mean, at this point in DB, you people ought to be able to regurgitate the six perfections like that.
Generosity.
My first one is usually considered is what?
Generosity.
What now?
Generosity.
Generosity is a good one. Yep. And what else?
Patience.
Morality.
Now, wait a minute.
Joyful,
you can't be talking to him all the time. We want the other ones to talk, too. So I want the other students to tell us what the six perfections are.
Concentration, wisdom.
Concentration and wisdom. This sort of the consider it toward the end, but yeah. What is another one? And I'm going to – so – anybody remember enthusiastic perseverance?
Joyful effort.
Usually that comes before concentration and wisdom. Enthusiasm. Enthusiasm for what? Enthusiasm for the practice of virtue. That's really what the enthusiasm is about. Then before that is patience or tolerance.
Morality and generosity.
Before that is morality. Or ethics. In fact, two-thirds of the Buddha's teachings are about ethics. Now, that's kind of interesting, isn't it? Two-thirds of the written word of the Buddha are about living ethically. And then, as Hima mentioned, generosity. You know, generosity, usually we think of generosity in terms of material generosity. There's another kind of generosity we talk about, which is about giving safety or protection. And then there's the generosity of giving the Dharma. Those are the kind of the three main forms of generosity. By the way, you know, when you talk about protection and stuff, that sounds a little weird. But yeah, that's an act of generosity if somebody's been threatened to go in and step in and try to stop the harm. But also, it's extremely generous for others if we can learn to develop our minds so that we're not the problem, We're not the one causing it. Okay? So those are the six perfections that we talk about. So we talk about generosity, ethics, which is moral discipline, which is the 10 perfections, you know, and they're in the degree of heaviness. Okay, we're talking about the 10 non-virtuous actions. Sorry, the 10 non-virtuous actions, the heaviest ones, the ones that have the most powerful karmic effect on our future, are the three of body. And then there's the next heaviest ones are the three of speech, four of speech, sorry. Or the next heaviest ones are the three of mind. And the reason is because the mind is the least heavy. The karmic actions created by the mind are the least heavy because the mind's so out of control. It's so difficult to manage to control the mind. But the heaviest negative karma is taking a life. Taking a life, killing, because we're robbing a living being of the opportunity for a precious human rebirth. We're robbing them of the opportunity to become enlightened, to become completely free of all suffering. So taking human life is a really big, the heaviest negative karma that we could create. And by the way, we're going to do Vajrasattva practice at the end of this so we can purify all this stuff. But we've done it all. We've done it all. Not you say, well, I've never killed anybody. I mean, you probably killed some insects, but I mean, when I was, you know, I mean, I'm a doctor. Listen, I'm sorry to say, but you know, I have to say, I'm not going to get into any details here, but probably most doctors have some skeletons in the closet. You never know. You know, there are actions of omission and commission. But, you know, so taking a life intentionally with a negative motivation is the heaviest of all negative karmas, okay? And stealing is another one. That's the second heaviest negative karma of body. And then adultery, which is basically unwise sexual behavior. I mean, typically it's having sex with somebody else's partner, but it's actually, you know, much bigger than that, as we all know. I mean, if you give somebody a disease or you know, a lot of things can go wrong in intimate relationships. So killing and stealing and adultery or sexual misconduct, kind of the three heaviest negative karmas, and they have to do with body. And then speech, lying. Everybody knows what that is, right? Deceiving others. Slander, which is bad-mouthing others, trying to turn people against somebody else. Harsh speech and frivolous speech. Okay? So, and again, that's in terms of heaviness. Lying is heavier than slander, is heavier than harsh speech, is heavier than frivolous speech. But they're all heavy. They all create... plant karmic seeds that will eventually ripen in terms of suffering. Now, in the Venerable Rabina says it better than anybody. She says, you know, first of all, it's virtually impossible to control our mind. Those are the next three, which are greed, hatred, and ignorance. So difficult to control the mind. Forget it. We're not there yet. Long, long way away. It's something we can aspire to. We're not there yet. But the one thing we do have some control over, at least more control over, is our body and our speech. So what does Rabina say? Come on. Somebody must remember Rabina.
I think part of it is keep your hands to yourself and the other part's to keep quiet, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, keep your hands to yourself and your mouth shut.
She says, zip your lip.
What now?
She says, zip your lip.
Zip your lips, yeah. Yeah, keep your hands to yourself and zip your lips. That's a good one. Because the actions of body and speech are much easier to control than our mind, okay? So at least that, and for a Dharma practitioner, these 10 non-virtuous actions, for somebody who aspires to be a Buddhist, or maybe you call yourself a Buddhist, or I call myself a Buddhist, this is the minimum. This is the minimum that we should aspire to be able to do, is to avoid these non-virtuous actions and to practice their opposites, which are the virtuous actions, which are saving lives and being generous instead of stealing and practicing, you know, instead of sexual misconduct. You know, if we're going to have an intimate relationship, at least be authentic about it and not harm anybody else. And then instead of lying, speaking truthfully, instead of slandering, actually, speaking well of other people. And instead of harsh speech, like gentle, kind, harmonious speech, instead of wasting people's time with gossip, you know, idle gossip, having meaningful conversations or just not having one at all. But don't waste your time and other people's time with idle gossip, which could end up backfiring and causing more and more problems. And then the opposite of attachment, we use attachment or greed or clinging or whatever of the three of mind, but what's the opposite of attachment is what? It's basically non-attachment. It's not clinging. It's not clinging, right? And that the opposite of anger, you can say, well, not being angry, but actually we oftentimes will talk about compassion or loving kindness as the opposite of anger. And the opposite of ignorance is wisdom. And there are different kinds of wisdom. It's not just the wisdom of emptiness, but it's the wisdom of seeing that, for example, having faith that you have the potential to become an extraordinary human being. You actually have the potential. You have this seed we call Buddha nature that could, with the right causal conditions, can ripen into you becoming a happier and happier being, having more and more days like this and fewer days like this. We have that potential to become fully enlightened. That's the claim of Buddhism. And we can actually taste it a little bit because we all know that we have a little bit of compassion, don't we? And we have a little bit of loving kindness. We have a little bit of power, okay, mental power, power to be able to accomplish things. And we have a little bit of what's called skillful means. These are the qualities of a Buddha. The Buddha knows what to say and what to do in any given situation to help that individual grow and open their mind and become a better person, a better human being. So, you know, we do have some sense about our Buddha potential. Okay. So that's, anyway, getting back to the three of body and the four of speech, those are the easier ones to control. The clinging attachment, the anger, and the ignorance, that's a different world. You know, oh, by the way, I wanted to finish up on wisdom, which is the opposite of ignorance. Is not only the wisdom of having some faith in our own Buddha potential, but there's also considering seeing the truth of past and future lifetimes is considered to be one aspect of wisdom. Considering or having faith, here we go, there's that word, faith in karma, that every action, 24/7, we're planting karmic seeds in our mental continuum, in our garden, as Venerable Rubina likes to say. You know, if we've gotten the weeds out by doing purification practices, then these seeds have this tremendous potential to grow. And so there's, so, you know, it's, so those are some of the aspects of wisdom. Anything that makes the mind happy, letting go, learning how to let go of attachment, faith in karma, faith in our past and future lifetimes, some sense or faith in the wisdom of emptiness. There are many aspects of what we call wisdom in Buddhism. It's not just the wisdom of emptiness. Okay? That's a good start. Let's just take a minute and see, I'm not going to give you any time to ask questions. That way I can get through my material, which is not going to happen anyway, but whatever. Well, actually, this will be a good time. Any questions so far? Hello.
I was just kind of trying to figure out where I fit in the Lam Rim and in this graduated path that we're working towards, you know. And as I'm trying to internalize Tantra, it kind of seems like one of the last or later steps in that graduated path, you know, as I'm accumulating wisdom, and you know, moving down those five paths. And so I'm trying to figure out kind of where next steps are. And one of the takeaways that I have from our Tantra class here is that I'm not ready, and probably a lot of us may not be ready to enter into Tantra. So I'm trying to think of where is that next step where I can progress and grow in my Buddhist practice.
Well, great question, and I have an answer. Might not be the one that you want to hear, but it's kind of interesting. There's a couple, actually. They're still married, Roger and Paula, but they both have become monks and nuns, so they have a different kind of marriage now. But early, I knew them when they were actually married in the traditional sense of the way of marriage. And at one point in their marriage, they wanted to do a 3-year retreat. And they did it at Milarepa Center. And that 3-year retreat is basically tantric practice for 3 years. And they built these little houses, and they didn't talk to each other for 3 years. 3 years, 3 months, and 3 days, actually, was the length. Actually, that's not true. They extended the retreat a whole nother year at Lama Zopa's request. So they actually went on 4 years and some change. But, you know, I was up at Milarepa because I had known them from the early 80s, and they've been friends of mine and forever and still are. And I said, like, okay, what did you get? What did you get? What did you learn from those 3 years, you know, from those 4 years and some change? And they said, it was just a deepening of our realization, even though they were doing tantric practice, of our realization of Lam Rim topics, of the Lam Rim. Tantra and Lam Rim are like so intimately entangled, it's unbelievable. Even though you think you're practicing Tantra, it is enhancing our realizations of the Lam Rim, all of the Lam Rim. So that's what they said. And I've heard other people who've done extended retreats, you know, these long tantric retreats, say it just makes your experience of the Lam Rim so much more real, so much more valid. So again, this is a real important point too, because what qualifies you as a, like, if the way to really expand your knowledge of the Lam Rim is Tantra, and yet you think of yourself as a beginner and you're not ready for Tantra, well, wait a minute, now something might be a little bit off. So the basic requirements to enter the tantric path, again, from, and this is our teachers talk about it all the time, it's renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness. And you do not have to have a perfect, you know, a perfect real, what they call realization. Everybody know what I mean by realization? Yeah? Where it becomes intuitive to you, where you understand whatever you're studying, you understand it, and it's in your marrow. It is how you react to the world. That's a realization. Your mind has been transformed into compassion. You don't realize compassion. Your mind's transformed into compassion. And that's how you relate to the world. That's a realization of compassion. Same way with loving kindness and wisdom and all the rest. So realization's a renunciation. So renunciation, this, you know, the determination to be free of suffering and to make it really simple. And you have to understand that you're suffering first, which of course many Westerners don't even think, you know, think, hey, well, right now during the pandemic, maybe a little bit easier to convince people that they're suffering, because I see a lot of, it in my practice, in my daily medical practice. I see people that are, you know, they've gained 15 pounds, their diabetes is out of control, they're depressed, they're stressed. Not everybody, but, you know, I've seen a lot of carnage from the last, whenever we shut things down in the middle of March. You know, there's been a lot of emotional and physical damage that's resulted from, and not only, you know, 250-some thousand people in this country have actually died from this. This is a big deal. So renunciation is this, it's actually based on some faith. First of all, an awareness of suffering, right? This is the suffering of pain, change, and pervasive suffering. You gotta get that, at least. You gotta realize that if you're vomiting up blood, you got a problem, right? So you recognize suffering, and you realize that you can be free. See, we don't believe we can be free of it. This is where renunciation, all of a sudden it stops, because we don't believe in ourselves. We don't have a real sense of our Buddha potential. But then maybe some of you do, and I can't speak for you, but I can say that through practice and through being around realized beings, it's actually possible, I say, to realize that we do have this Buddha potential. We have this potential to become enlightened. Okay? So when you say renunciation, the determination to be free implied in that is you believe you can be free. But most of us don't think we can be free. We think we're this glob of flesh with these body bags, basically. We got skin, and there's a bunch of organs and stuff crammed in here, and we got a brain, and it spews off. We think our brain produces thinking instead of, consciousness as something that is dependent upon the brain, but not the brain. We don't have that sense, do we? So renunciation is crucial. It's having some faith in your own potential to be free of suffering and realizing that we are suffering, and then having this determination to be free of it. That's renunciation. So just realizing, if you just get what I said, if you got a sense of it, that's enough. That's enough. And then bodhicitta is, and I'm going to use Jeffrey Hopkins' language here, is based on genuine love and compassion, not sentimentality, not, you know, none of that willy-nilly stuff. It's based on a real sense of interconnectedness with all living beings, okay, and wanting them to be happy and have the causes of happiness, and wanting them to be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. That's genuine love and compassion, okay? If we have that, based on that, which we call universal love and compassion, it doesn't cherry pick. It doesn't just pick the people that are like us or from the same political party or that are, or that, you know, whatever, the same sex, the same whatever. It's like, or even the same species. It's all living beings. It's this universal compassion and loving kindness. That's what bodhicitta is based on. So we call it universal, this attitude of universal love and compassion. Based on that attitude, and again, it's something that can be cultivated through these a series of meditations that we've talked about in the past. Based on that, then we come to the point where, as Jeffrey says, based on genuine love and compassion, we dedicate our lives to become enlightened in order to help others. Or to say it another way, we dedicate our life to others. And the best way to do that is to develop ourselves, to develop our qualities, to develop, fully develop love, fully develop compassion, fully develop power, fully develop skillful means. Okay? So based on genuine loving compassion, which is not easy. It takes a lot of work to get to even hear these words and to actually develop a feeling for them. But based on genuine love and compassion, we aspire for supreme enlightenment in order to help others. Not just help them, but guide them from whatever state of confusion and pain and suffering they're in now to supreme enlightenment. The claim is, I'm going to do this myself alone. I take personal responsibility for the happiness of universal living beings, and I'm going to become enlightened so I can guide them to supreme enlightenment by myself alone. Pretty wild, isn't it? But that's the claim. Bodhicitta is this wish to become enlightened for the sake of others. It's antithetical to ego, isn't it? Ego wants me, I. It wants me to be happy. It's very self-centered. It's very selfish. Egocentricity. Bodhicitta is the opposite of that. It's like, I want others to be happy. I want to guide others to supreme happiness. And the method is for me to develop my qualities perfectly. For me to be blissfully happy, you know, blissfully wise, compassionate, and skillful. So that's bodhicitta. That's the second thing that we need to have in our mental continuum to be ready to practice or be introduced to tantra practice. And third is the wisdom of emptiness. And Venerable George talked about it, you know, in the Heart Sutra. Lama Zopa loves to talk about it. Robbie likes it. Everybody likes to talk about emptiness. But it's not easy, is it? You know, Lama Yeshe, he kind of, I said this in the first class, he just said, look, you just strip away the paint. Just strip away your projections. And that's not easy to do. Strip away your projections, the paint job that you've done on reality. When we can strip that away and see things as they are, minus our projections. That is wisdom. That's the wisdom of emptiness. Because when we start looking for things, the things that we think are true are just things that the mind has conjured up, right? Not that we don't exist, not that you don't exist, not that you're a man, you're a woman, you know, you're young, I'm old. All of those things are concepts, the conceptual mind, you know? And so we construct our whole reality, you know, based on this conceptual mind, which is, in fact, not the truth. For example, the most important, they say the most important when you're meditating on emptiness, the first step in meditating on emptiness is meditating on emptiness of yourself. And so when you start looking for the sense of I, and I'm not talking about just any I, I'm talking about this real sense of you. Like if I said, hey, you, what are you talking about? And I pointed at you in a room full of people, you know, and all of a sudden everybody looked at you. And you go, oh, my God, you know, you feel so, your ego, your brain would, your mind would explode. Okay, that sense of I, the sense of I that when we sometimes call the emotional I, when we real strong attachment or real strong anger or fear, we can see that sense of I much more clearly. It's this sense of a truly existent, hardwired, inherently existent I. That's the I. That I that I'm speaking about is the product of ignorance. Ignorance, our fundamental ignorance, projects a false sense of I. Now, we do exist, right? Everybody get this? I'm not saying we don't exist, but ignorance projects a false sense of I. And we even say, my chair, my book, my computer, my car, my house, my wife, my kids, everything's about, you know, we project this false sense of I. And the problem is, it's not wrong, it's not anything wrong with believing that we exist or that there is an I, but it's that we cling to it and we believe it to be truly existent. And it's a mere label. It's just a nominal label. It's based on reality, on parts. It's based on cause and conditions, parts, because the body is made up of fingers and atoms and lots of stuff, right? You know, so that's a valid label for I. And then anything beyond that is ignorance. So when we say, when we talk about the emptiness of self, we're talking about not that we disappear or that we don't exist. We're saying that false sense of I that's projected by ignorance is not true. And it's that I that gets angry when somebody says, you're an asshole, excuse my French, or you're a jerk, or you think you see something you want, and you go, I want that. You know, it's that I, that false sense of I that's being negated in the view of emptiness. So when Islami Yeshi says, if we can strip away that, the paint, you know, the paint job, if we can strip away that and see things for what they are, then our natural Buddha nature arises. And it is compassion and wisdom and kindness and all the good things that we want to achieve. But it's been so layered over by ignorance, we don't have any real sense of it. But so having some intellectual understanding of renunciation and bodhicitta and the correct view of reality, or, you know, seeing the wisdom of emptiness, having just an intellectual understanding of that is said to be enough to begin to dabble in Tantra. And the key thing in Tantra, again, as I go back to this again and again, is you got to find a teacher, and you got to find somebody that you trust and that you're willing to entrust your spiritual real estate to, because they're going to guide you. And when you enter the tantric path, you have to have a guide. It's kind of like, I don't know what a good example is other than that. I mean, if you're going to climb Mount Everest, and there's, just imagine that there's nobody there, right? Right now, there's probably 1,000 people in line trying to get up there to the top of the mountain right this minute. But back in the old days, it'd be good to have a guide. So if you're trying to make it to the top of the mountain, you need a guide. And this is, and spirituality and Tantra in particular, because there's a danger involved in misunderstanding it, Sometimes that's why we call it secret mantra, secret tantra. There's a, it can, heresy, as Amazapa likes to say, heresy can arise. People's misunderstanding of tantra can cause them to lose faith in Buddhism and just completely give up. So it's very important to have a correct understanding of three principles of the path, and then a qualified teacher, an initiation. You got to be willing to take the vows that go along with the initiation, try to keep them purely to the best of your ability, and then you practice, and then you plant the seeds that maybe in this lifetime you don't make it, but in the next lifetime you created the causes to meet Tantra again, and then again and again and again, until you get enlightened. And so that's kind of the beauty of it. It's like you have the opportunity by just hearing these teachings tonight, seeds are being planted, and maybe you go, well, I'm not ready for Tantra. That's fine. If that's the way you feel, it's okay. But if you understand the three principles of the path, you are ready for Tantra. But not at the highest level. You know, remember there are four levels. There's action, performance, yoga, and highest yoga Tantra. Well, action Tantra has to do with, you know, in the center, there's Chinrezig or Avalokiteshvara, you know, thousand-armed Chinrezig, there's four-armed Chinrezig, there's Green Tara, there's Manjushri, there's Vajrapani. These are all Kriya Tantra, action Tantra deities that we can actually get initiated into. By the way, if you want to see yourself as a deity, imagine yourself as a deity, you must have an initiation. But you don't have to have an initiation to visualize the deity in front of you. Okay? So you can do a front generation. And Lama Zopa, let's see here. Can you see that? A lot of you have got this little booklet here. I know Donna's recognized it. He might recognize it. And do other people see this? It's been at the center. It's put out by Lama Ishwar Archives. It's a daily purification practice using Vajrasattva. And that's based on a harsh yoga tantra image. But it's a practice that Lama Zopa has given us permission to do, to purify our negative karma, because that's the biggest obstacle to our happiness is, well, two things really. We have to purify our negative karma, and we have to create the causes for happiness by practicing virtue. So those two things have to go hand in hand, right? Any questions? Any other questions?
I think I tried learning from different teachers in Tantra itself, like Amy or different classes, just to see how it is taught differently. And some of them were beneficial for me because some of them were making me sick. So I had to switch my learning differently or practicing differently.
Mm-hmm.
That helped me.
And then, what particularly helped you in the practice?
When I was doing the Vajrasattva regularly, somehow I am sorry for the noise. My son is making food. I was really dizzy and I couldn't even walk for like 6 months. I'm diabetic, but my condition was reacting, or I'm not sure what it was. Then when Steve told me, instead of doing Vajrasattva, I should do Medicine Buddha.
Medicine Buddha, yeah.
Yeah, then my health got better. But yesterday, I don't know what I did. Today, I'm like so dizzy, super dizzy.
Today, you're what?
I'm super dizzy today.
Super dizzy today, well.
Yes, it started when I was doing the... So for me, any food change can make it worse. I just had like light juice, then I can go dizzy that way. But somehow Medicine Buddha is the one that helped me. So I will
think that if I take a deity, Tara or Medicine Buddha, that would be, you know.
Yeah.
I also study with a secular Buddhist teacher from the beginning of my study, from 2012. So I always go back to him.
Right.
It helps me with every study I do, every teacher I, different studies I do. I go back to him to ask questions or where I am, what do I do next. So I have guidance that way.
Right. Okay. So there's a couple of ways that we can do a tantric, you know, I discussed this at the last class, the tantric sadhana. Let me see if I can find it again. Yeah. This is a tantric sadhana. There's a couple of them. I got one on, this is the forearm chinrezig sadhana, which you can, which we could do tonight, actually. Maybe this would be a good way to end up the class, even though we're going to run over 8 o'clock, but that's okay. It's a tantric sadhana. Sadhana means method of accomplishment. So whenever you take initiation or empowerment into a particular practice, you're given a sadhana, and you try to do that every day for the rest of your life. I mean, that's the commitment. So obviously there's a big, you know, commitments involved in taking tantric initiations that maybe we're not ready to take because we're not sure about, we don't have faith in tantra, we're not sure if it works, we don't have a qualified teacher, we don't have faith in the teacher. All those things would be deal breakers for you to practice or to be initiated into a tantric practice. By the way, there, over the years, there have been numerous teachers that have been floating through Raleigh, but not so much anymore, but back in the 90s anyway, there were a lot of teachers that would come through and give tantric initiations, and people didn't even know who they were talking, listening to. And I'll take some credit for that, negative credit, that is. Because I would invite, you know, there might be a group of monks from, Drepung Losenling, and they'd be coming through town, and they need a place to stay, and they would do these sacred dance and sacred music, and they used performances. This was back in the 90s, and there would always be one teacher, one guru with them, and he would always give an empowerment or initiation. And people took it as a blessing. And that's okay too, by the way. You can go to an empowerment or an initiation and take it as a blessing, not with the intention of doing the practice every day or the mantras every day, but just being taking it as a blessing. So that's another little tidbit, something to think about. Any other questions about tantra? Is that a hand up or no? Sorry. Thought I saw somebody raise a hand, but I guess not. Okay, so let's, I'm going to go back to the beginning. We're going to back up here a little bit. And let's see. Well, I'll show you some cool pictures. Let's see. Can you see that? See, this is where I usually sit and do some practices. This is a picture. You can't see it, but it's the Dalai Lama and my three girls. They got to meet him in Washington, D.C., and my ex-wife. We all got to spend about 20 minutes, well, 10 minutes. I don't want to exaggerate. Hanging out with him in Washington, D.C. when he gave the Kala Chakra initiation back around, what was it? 2014, Donna, you think?
I think it was 2011.
Really? My gosh. That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Anyway, and back here is the picture of the Dalai Lama and my ex-wife and me. And this was in the Spiti Valley, way up in northern India. His Holiness was given a Kala Chakra initiation there. We were on our honeymoon. This was in the year 2000. I only say this because I want to mention what he said. The only reason I got to see him, by the way, is because his brother, Tenzin Chogyo, happened to be my landlord when I worked at Delhi Hospital in Dharamsala, India. And I stayed in his guest house. So we became good friends. And so he was able to finagle things for me to be able to meet His Holiness on several occasions where otherwise I may never have met him. But anyway, when Linda and I met him, you know, he had a little bit of altitude sickness, and we were just chatting, and Tenzin Chogyo was there, and his Holiness was talking about the Queen Mother and how he'd sent her a statue of Tara and blah, blah, blah. And then I said, what's the most important thing in a relationship? Because you're on your honeymoon. You would like to know what's the most important thing in a relationship. And he boiled it down to one word. What do you think he said?
Kindness.
Kindness is subsumed in this word. He said respect. And when you start unpacking that word, it is unbelievable how many layers of, you know, it is kindness, it is compassion, it is forgiveness. It's everything that makes a relationship work. And that's what he said, respect. And then I've got a little thing over here. He says, my religion is kindness and things like that. But His Holiness was, but that really kind of, I don't know what I was expecting, but it was not that. It was something like, I thought maybe he was going to give me a 5-minute chat on on how to make a relationship. But respect is the most important thing.
Yeah,
so let's do...
Aretha.
Pardon?
I said, and he probably never met Aretha.
Yes. Yes. So we're going to do... I would do this practice, but most people, I don't... How many people here don't know the 100-syllable mantra? See, so it wouldn't be fair to do it, because it would just, you'd feel kind of, because it's more important when you're saying the 100-syllable mantra to do the visualizations than it is to just say the mantra. But everybody knows Om Mani Padme Hum, right? Real easy. So we can do this one. So let's sit up and do a little meditation here for about 2 to 3 minutes, kind of, let go of all of this conversation and blah, 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 and sit up straight and take a couple of deep breaths. And as you exhale, just let go of any expectations, any negative energy, whatever's happened to you today, just kind of let it go as you exhale. And do 2 or 3 deep breaths. And then just bring your mindfulness to the experience of breathing in and out. And that might be focusing on the breath at the nose or the rising and falling of the abdomen. It can also be just the sensation of your body sitting in the chair or on the cushion, whatever works for you. We'll do this for a few minutes. I'm going to read this short form Shinrezig practice. And Shinrezig, all you just need to think about is Shinrezig is the the embodiment of all the compassion of the Buddha. And so there's a form and a 1,000-arm Shinrezig practice. But we're just doing this. This is from the sadhana, from the forms and basic practice. So just listen along. Try to connect with the meaning of the words as best you can. All right. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my merit from giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my merit from giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my merit from giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. So the first two lines have to distinguish a Buddhist from a non-Buddhist, right? I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. That's the basic premise of a Buddhist, is that that's where you go for refuge, for solace, for support in your spiritual practice. And then by the merit of giving and other perfections, which is the six perfections, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. That's bodhicitta. But that's distinguishing you from somebody who practices for individual liberation to somebody who practices for to benefit universal living beings, or the Mahayana mode. Okay? So that's what refuge in bodhicitta. That's our first prayer. And then the four immeasurables. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. That's actually the definition of love, immeasurable love. Immeasurable compassion is may all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. By the way, if you don't feel connected to others, if you hate them and they're suffering, you cannot feel compassion. So the words won't mean anything. So you have to have equanimity and love before compassion can arise. So may all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. That is compassion. That's the words that describe the experience of compassion. They are not compassion. They're words that if compassion could speak, these are the words it would speak. Compassion is a feeling. It's an experience, and it's experiential. Okay? That's what we're talking about here. Immeasurable compassion is experiential, and it would wish all beings to be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. Immeasurable joy. May all sentient beings not be separated from higher rebirth and the bliss of liberation. So may all living beings not be separated from higher rebirth and the bliss and the joy of being liberated from samsara. And immeasurable equanimity. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment and hatred, holding some as close and others as distant. So we say, you know, attachment is clinging. You know, there's beneficial attachment and there's afflictive attachment. We're talking about the clinging attachment that causes us and others to suffer. And hatred causes everybody to suffer. We all understand that. So may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment and hatred, holding some close and others distant. May my root guru, the quintessence of all refuge objects, to my root guru, and that would be the teacher that you most connect with as your guru, as your spiritual guide. To my root guru, the quintessence of all refuge objects, I go for refuge. Please bless my mind with your transforming powers. To my root guru, the quintessence of all refuge objects, I go for refuge. Please bless my mind with your transforming powers. For my root guru, the quintessence of all refuge objects, I go for refuge. Please bless my mind with your transforming powers. Now this is the visualization that we're going to do. Above the crown of your head and above the crowns of all living beings, sentient beings, infinite is space. So you imagine that you're surrounded by universal living beings, all in human form, above the crown of your head and all these infinite sentient beings is a white lotus and a moon disc. On this appears the white letter Hri. Now that's a Sanskrit letter, which, you know, but it's spelled H-R-I-H, which our teachers have said you can visualize it, you know, as H-R-I-H, but it's actually a Sanskrit syllable that's above the crown of our head and universal living beings, Hri, okay, which transforms into the protector, my root guru Chinrezig. So on the lotus and the mundus, this Hri above the crown of our head instantly transforms from the space of emptiness into the manifestation of wisdom and compassion, our root guru Chinrezig. Okay? He is white in color, has one face and four arms. His first two hands are joined together at his heart, holding wish-fulfilling gem. So you might see him at the center. You might see Chinrezig, the form Chinrezig. He holds a jewel between his hands. It's called the wish-fulfilling jewel, and it symbolizes universal living beings. It's actually what it symbolizes. Okay? So the first two hands join together at the heart, holding a wish-fulfilling gem. The second right hand holds a crystal rosary, symbolizing, you know, the mantras, the Chinrezig's mantra, Mani Padme Hum. While his left hand holds a white lotus. And the lotus, a white lotus that you see in Buddhism a lot, because if you've ever seen, been to a lotus pond, they're all muddy. But lotuses come from the mud, and out of the mud comes this, I don't know what you'd call it, but then it blooms into this beautiful white flower. So in the same way as our mind is in the, you know, sort of mired down in the mud of confusion, we have the potential to arise out of that mud and become like a lotus, like completely pure and white. So that's the symbolism of the lotus. Okay? He is seated in cross-legged Vajra posture, which means like yoga, like Vajra is like cross-legged, clothed in fine silk garments, and is adorned with precious ornaments. An antelope skin covers his shoulder. That one has to do with compassion. On the crown of his head sits Buddha Amitabha, who's basically his guru. At his crown, throat, and heart are the syllables Om. So crown would be, you could think of it here or in the front, but actually here, Om. Ah is at the throat, symbolizing. Om symbolizes body. Ah is for speech. And Hum is at the heart. And that syllable is for the mind. So body, speech, and mind are those three syllables. And we imagine that this visualization is not just some static image or like a statue, but it's a living presence. We're in the living presence of the Buddha of compassion that we have created with our imagination. But that energy is always with us. But now we've been able to crystallize it in the form of the Buddha of compassion, the form Chinrezig, with Om Ahum, Om at the crown, Ah at the throat, Hum at the heart. Okay? Now, I'm going to say the seven-limb prayer. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. present clouds of every type of offering I shall imagine. Declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please, Guru Buddha, remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. And then we do a mandala offering. And this is, again, all of these rituals and things like this. We go, oh my God, I'm not into rituals. I'm not interested in rituals. Trust me, if you do a retreat, the rituals are so important. They're so helpful. They like keep you in the game. They help you touch on the points that are important for you to remember so that the meditations that follow go well. So the mandala offering, this ground anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this is a Buddha field and I offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Ratnam Mandala Kame Yata Yami. Now next, we do the prostrations and praise. Now, this is a fairly standard presentation for a sadhana, where you go through refuge and bodhicitta, the four measurables, you know, you do the visualization, you do seven limb prayer, mandala offering, and then you do prostrations and praise to Chinrezi. To Arya Chinrezi, whose body is pure white, unstained by defilements, whose head is adorned by the fully enlightened Buddha Amitabha, you gaze upon all sentient beings with the eyes of boundless compassion. To you, Lord Chinrezi, I prostrate. So now you're paying homage to Chinrezi in that last stanza. Now the visualization for the mantra recitation. As I make heartfelt prayers, infinite beams of five-colored nectar light, white, red, blue, and yellow, radiate from the holy body of Chinrezi. The light rays touch me and all sentient beings. The nectar purifies all delusions, negative karma, illness, obscurations, and their latencies. The external environment becomes pure like Sukhavati. Body, speech, and mind of myself and all beings become the body, speech, and mind of Lord Chinrezi. All appearances, sounds, and awarenesses become inseparable from emptiness. With this visualization, one can recite the long mantra, which is, there's a long Chinrezig mantra, which we're not going to do, or the short mantra, the Om Mani Padme Hum mantra. We're going to do it 108 times. And I'm just reading the fine print here. Meditate on the above visualization as you recite the mantra. Imagine that all beings are reciting the mantra together with you. The benefit of reciting the six-syllable mantra is particularly are limitless. It eliminates the suffering of the six realms and the six root delusions, anger, greed, pride, doubt, wrong views, and ignorance. In this life, we can receive protection from fear, suffering, sickness, and spirits, dangers to life, and disturbing dreams. The six perfections, generosity, ethics, patience, energy, concentration, and wisdom are attained. In the future, you will be reborn in Sukhavati, the pure land of Amitabha Buddha, and ultimately you will attain the holy body, speech, mind, qualities and activities of Arya Chinrezi. And then after the mantra recitation, we can recite and meditate on the request. I think we'll just do the mantra recitation for right now. So, everybody got an idea of what we need to do. So these five colored lights are going to come from the heart of the form Chinrezig and go out to universal living beings. and transform them into enlightened beings and having all the qualities of a Buddha. So as we do this together, and I'm going to start out by doing the first 21 mantras out loud, then we can do the remainder of them. I've got a mala here with 108 beads, so toward the end. But try to do, it's important to say each syllable of the mantra. And when you're doing retreat, for example, you say the mantra just loud enough so that you could hear it. But if somebody was sitting next to you, they couldn't hear it. But you can do it silently or you can do it out loud. But in retreat, you do it the way I just described. So we're going to do this. And importantly, just as importantly is the visualization that we do as we recite the mantra. Om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. And now, before we move on, imagine that around you are your mother of this life and your father of this, mother on the left, father on the right, and behind you are your children and your close friends, and in front of you are people that you have some difficulty with, and do the mantra again, imagining that the light. The five colored lights are going out to real people in your life, not just universal living beings, which we tend to don't even really feel connected to, but real people. And imagine that the real people in your life are receiving the blessings of this mantra, such that all of their obstacles and as the light rays touch them, they're purified of their delusions and negative karma and illness and obscurations. And that their body, speech, and mind are blessed and become the holy body, speech, and mind of Guru Chinrezig. Let's say it just maybe 21 more times to yourself, but really think about individuals that you want to send this energy to help them purify their minds and develop and transform themselves into the Buddha of compassion. Om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Then we're going to do, I'm going to do the requests this is a request for the for the Buddha of compassion. Praise to the beautiful form, Lord of the world, sublime embodiment emanating from the unity of all the victorious ones of the three times, possessor of all the knowledge and holder of the lotus, your immaculate feet beautifully ornament my crown. May the karmic pollutions of myself and others be washed away by the cool tear of your compassion, great loving protector, sole refuge of pitiful transmigrating beings who have no guide. You generated bodhicitta first, and then you reach the extreme limit. O merciful one, please behold with your compassionate eye the beings of the evil gone, caught in realms difficult to escape, experiencing the individual results of our former negative actions, as hell beings, hungry ghosts, animals, jealous gods, and so on. Behold with compassion the thoughtless ones who return empty-handed. Even their high rebirth was without meaning. Their human bodies were so rare and fragile, but their lives were consumed only in suffering. Amidst their endless actions, the Lord of Death arrived. Behold with compassion tough-skinned beings like me who maintain a religious manner but do not achieve the great meaning. Being overwhelmed by attachment, hatred, and the eight worldly concerns, without having subdued our minds by observing cause and result, with compassion, please lead those without refuge on the path, for when their vision of this life fades and the vision of their self-created karma arises as the enemy in the bardo, may they be taken on a precipitous route, and they are taken on a precipitous route by Yama's messenger. Look upon us with compassion, O Lama Chenrezig, mother attached by compassion to all sentient beings, who is the special soul refuge of the snowland. May I and all beings quickly attain your state of enlightenment. And then finally, the dedication. All the Chenrezigs from above the heads of myself and all sentient beings melt into light and dissolve into me and each sentient being, each of the universal living beings that are surrounding you. Imagine that Chenrezig melts into light and becomes oneness with these universal living beings. And the body, speech, and mind of myself and all beings become one with the holy body, speech, and mind of Guru Chenrezig. Due to these merits, may I quickly become Arya Chenrezig and lead all sentient beings to his enlightened realm. May the precious Bodhi mind not yet born arise and grow, and may that born have no decline but increase forevermore. Amen. Okay, well, that is the end. You can bring your attention back into the room. That's the end of Discovering Buddhism, Introduction to Tantra. Until next time. I think I'm teaching it again in 2 years, right, Donna? Pardon?
You've got a job for life, Don.
I tell you though, teaching it is the best way to learn it, obviously, and it's very helpful. So I appreciate the opportunity that Discovering Buddhism gives me to teach these different subjects that are so helpful to my mind. And, you know, it's really an honor to be able to do it. So thank you. And also thank you, the students who've put your life on hold for a few hours. You could have been watching some really good, you know, whatever on the internet or television. But anyway, thank you for your attention and making an effort to at least make some connection with these teachings. And then a lot of, you know, whether you believe it or not, I do, I believe that seeds were planted, karmic seeds were planted that will ripen in future happiness, definitely will ripen in some future opportunity to practice Tantra, and hopefully ripen, and they will ripen in us if we do practice Tantra purely, will ripen in us achieving the state of a fully enlightened Buddha. And it's only through Tantra that we can achieve the state of a fully enlightened Buddha. So it's important to at least make the karmic connections with these teachings, even if we don't think like we're ready to jump in, you know, with both feet, just making that connection so precious. So thank you. And bless you.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you. Thank you. I ran
I
over.
I have one quick question. Anybody
sure.
The book Venerable George used the about Tantra, just the one main one he was using?
I'm sorry, say it again.
The book Venerable George was using, the main one for the Tantra class this weekend. Anybody has any idea?
I don't think he was using any book. Okay. He was just teaching from his experience.
Okay.
Yeah. But there are a lot of, if you go back and look, there's quite a few books. His Introduction to Tantra by Lama Yeshe, edited by John Landau. That's a book by Wisdom, published by Wisdom Publications. I think is still out there. There are quite a few books on, and I would suggest that you rely on books by qualified teachers. For example, like Lama Zopa, like particularly His Holiness the Dalai Lama has some books on that are introductions to Tantra. You may be, sometimes you'll be overwhelmed by some of the jargon, the language. I hate to say jargon because that has a negative connotation, but there's big words that have long meanings, but you just read it and try to be open to whatever you get. And then
okay.
Try to do a little bit of practice, even doing 108 Chinrezig mantras a day or doing Medicine Buddha practice. Do you have a sadhana for Medicine Buddha practice, Nada?
Yeah, I have, I didn't sign, but I'm constantly doing it.
Yeah.
It's
if
like on
my time. Yeah.
Not my
time. Yeah. Richard, you showed me sadhana. But there's sadhanas at the center that you can buy. You can buy them through the FPMT if you want to do a particular practice. But you cannot, you know, George mentioned this. We don't have permission to see ourselves as a Buddha. In other words, that's something that when we get the initiation, what happened is you meditate on emptiness. And all your sense of ordinariness just completely disappears in space. And then what we do is we consciously cause a compassionate wisdom consciousness, our compassionate wisdom consciousness to arise as a Buddha figure. It could be Chinrezig, it could be Manjushri, it could be Green Tara, or any of the White Tara, any of the Tantric deity Buddha figures that we use in Tantra. So that's, there are lots of different books out there, but we don't have permission to see ourselves as a deity until we have an empowerment by a qualified guru. And we have to be qualified ourselves by having taken refuge and have some at least appreciation for the three principles of the path that I discussed earlier. So without any further ado, I will sign off and let this Zoom come to an end. Thank you.
Don, before you go, let me just, because there was a question in chat, and I think it's easier if I just say it. A question was about when is the next DB class start? And we're at the very end of the two-year cycle. We're starting a new cycle in January with Mind and Its Potential. it's not determined yet whether that will start on the 4th or on the 11th, but you'll have all of December to relax and recover. And if you want to, if you haven't caught all of DBs, then it's good to start again with starting in January.
But by the way, I would say this, a lot of people have done Discovering Buddhism multiple times. And so, you know, I mean, I've done it multiple. I don't know. I mean, I find that the topics of Discovering Buddhism are the heart and soul of everything that we do at Kadampa Center. So if you've done it once, do it again and again and again, as many times as you can, because you can't, repetition is not a bad thing. In fact, it's a good thing. All right. Anything else?
Nope.
All right.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So much. Have a good night.
Good night.
Good night, everyone.
Thank you, Hayman.